Hey, I want to give a shout out. We got our first ever fan meme in anticipation of this episode. Thank you very much to David Sheely. You can check that out on our page on Facebook.
Today's Dead Idea, this is part two of our continuing series on the pre-World War I balance of power system in Europe, which believed so long as you had everybody allied into these big alliances, you would never get a major war. And boy, were they wrong. But anyway, today we're going to talk about a period earlier to World War I. In the 18th century, this balance of power system supposedly evolved a kind of restricted warfare called the Cabinet Wars. And no one was a truer cabinet warrior than Frederick the Great of Prussia, whom Napoleon later admired as the most brilliant tactician in history. Last time we heard some doubts about whether there really was such a thing as this restricted warfare, but if there ever was, it was Frederick the Great. That's what we're talking about today on Dead Ideas. Hey, thanks for listening, everybody. The music we just heard was composed by Rachel Westhoff, my lovely wife, with whom I am nearing checkmate in our war over actual cabinets in our new house. I'm B.T. Newberg. You can call me Brandon. We've been talking about the balance of power idea, which is the idea that powerful states should be grouped into alliances such that they balance each other out in terms of power, so that any major engagement between them would only result in stalemate, and no one would be enough of a nincompoop to actually start such a pointless war. But start wars they did! There was no shortage of wars during this period between the 1648 Peace of Westphalia and the French Revolutionary Wars, which started in 1792. During this period, wars were waged according to something called Kabinettskriege, or Cabinet Wars, and this was a peculiar kind of restricted warfare, or so we're told. This was characterized by limited aims in war, more noble and civilized conduct in war, and tactics of outmaneuvering the enemy such that they might concede defeat without a shot fired, and in the end, less territorial exchange so that the victor doesn't really gain that much nor the loser lose that much, and thus the balance of power is preserved. And we talked about this restricted warfare last time and expressed some doubts as to how restricted it really was, but today we're going to take a closer look and we're going to zoom in on one of the great military men of history, Friedrich der Große, Frederick the Great, the man who took tiny, tiny little Prussia and took on pretty much every great power in Europe almost single-handedly and won. And I mean, just it's like when you're playing one of those video games where you can play any of the powers in the war, like World War II, or you choose for some reason to be like Belgium, or you know, some tiny little place with hardly any army compared to the rest, and you're somehow supposed to, you know, defeat a giant like Germany. Well, Prussia was kind of like a tiny little Belgium because there was no Germany at the time. It was all these independent little states. Prussia was very small compared to the powers that it was taking on. Somehow Frederick the Great managed to turn this into a fighting machine that was just nearly unstoppable. Well, kind of. We'll get into it. So Frederick II was king of Prussia from 1740 to 1786, and he was both a prime exemplar and kind of the prime antithesis to much of what we've been talking about in this series. He wrote about the importance of the balance of power and idealized quite a bit about it, yet he probably did more than anyone else in his time to upset that balance. And also, his tactics came to exemplify the kind of restricted cabinet warfare that we talked about last time, but in his early days, his style was anything but restricted. So today, first, we're going to have a look at his youth, and then we are going to read some of his own writings on military political theory, and finally, we're going to see how his bellicose career went for him and how he sort of changed over the years. and we're going to learn plenty about the so-called restricted warfare of the Cabinet Wars along the way. Okay, so let's get started. So Frederick the Great was born in 1712, and almost from the very start, he had major daddy issues. It was just classic. He and his father were opposites in almost every way. His father, Frederick Wilhelm, which I'm just going to call William from now on to avoid any kind of confusion with Frederick himself. Okay, so William was a devout Calvinist. Frederick was a non-practicing Calvinist. And he even wrote a secret satire, which was critical of religion, among other things, called The Palladian. So completely opposite on the religious spectrum. Next, his father was uninterested in any kind of like frilly art, culture, music, whatever. Frederick was very much a patron of the arts, and he surrounded himself with artists, promoted the culture of his people, and cultivated a long-lasting relationship by letter with Voltaire, of all people. So totally different in that respect as well. Next, his father, William, was a hyper-masculine kind of guy, just really into the army, really into just being like, I'm a man, kind of a king. Whereas Frederick was, on the other hand, straight up homosexual. So that didn't go well between them. Frederick was gay, and he actually remarked of his soon-to-be enemy, Maria Theresa of Austria, quote, fortune has it in for me. She is a woman, and I am not that way inclined. So, yeah. It was an interesting time, because it was kind of like if you've seen the recent period drama of Versailles, where the King of France's brother is gay and also completely into war. Like, that was not weird back then, to be both gay and super into killing people. It's kind of weird that it's weird now, in fact, if you think about it. So anyway, that was another big thing that divided his father and him. But there was one thing that they were the same on, and that was they were both military men. That was where they really... But it didn't necessarily bring them together. They had varying opinions even on that. So anyway, yeah, major daddy issues. In fact, Frederick was always closer to his sister Wilhelmina than to his father or really anyone else in his family. So his father, Frederick William, right, is super into the military, builds up the Prussian army up to 80,000 men. And considering how tiny Prussia was at the time, and we'll have maps at www.deadideas.net, you can go and check all this out. We're going to have lots of maps on there for everything, otherwise it'd be totally confusing this episode. So check that out. For the size of Prussia, that's a big frickin' army. It's actually one soldier for every 28 citizens. And we can compare this to Britain at the time, which had one soldier for every 310 citizens. So that's a big army for that size of state. Furthermore, King William was really into tall soldiers for some reason. He had a weakness, quote unquote, as he called it, for tall soldiers. And when he was down, he would have them parade in front of his sick bed or whatever, and it would cheer him up. He created a regiment called the Potsdam Giants, which came to be called by the people Lange Kerls, or tall guys. And the original minimum height for recruiting was 6'2", or 1.88 meters tall. And these Potsdam Giants were recruited from all over Europe, and they were even sent to Prussia by other rulers as diplomatic gifts. The tallest among them was actually an Irishman named James Kirkland at 7'2", or 2.17 meters tall. There are even stories of them using not exactly the most noble means of getting their soldiers, like impressment and abduction and things. One story that I read, which is almost certainly not true, but it claimed to be highly verified, But anyway, it's too good to pass up. It was a story of a recruiter that discovers this carpenter who is, of course, very tall. And so he's like, And he asks the carpenter to craft a coffin, but he wants it to be big, big enough that you yourself, carpenter sir, could fit inside it comfortably. And I want it to be that big, right? You can already see what's coming. So the carpenter makes this coffin for him, and the recruiter comes back and says, "Nah, it looks kind of small. I wanted it to be big enough that you could fit inside it." And the carpenter's like, "Oh, it is, look!" And he gets inside the coffin. And then the recruiter has his men immediately shut the top of the coffin down, and then they carry him off to abduct him to become part of the Potsdam Giants. But unfortunately, the carpenter suffocates within the coffin, and that's the end of the story. So Daddy King William has this thing for tall soldiers. Frederick would later scoff at this and just view it as a frivolous and unnecessary expense and merge the men into other units. But anyway, major point of difference between them. Frederick likes, as I said, music, literature, the arts, and so on. And this, when this becomes apparent, it becomes a major dividing point between him and his father. And at age 16, then, Frederick has a homosexual relationship with the king's 13-year-old page boy, a boy by the name of Peter Carl Christoph Keith. And when his father catches wind of this, he is not happy at all. He sends Keith off to an unpopular regiment, way off in the sticks somewhere, I don't know. And Frederick is retired to his father's hunting lodge to quote-unquote repent of his sins. So he immediately puts the kibosh on that. This really doesn't help things between Frederick and his father, and at age 18, Frederick actually attempts to flee to England with his friend Hans Hermann von Katta, which he actually met at the hunting lodge. But they're redded out by Frederick's brother, who kind of like has a fit of conscience and is like, maybe we shouldn't do this, and rats them out to the king, and they're captured. And then both of them are accused of treason against the state. Frederick is then forced to watch his friend Katta decapitated. Meanwhile, Frederick himself is granted a pardon, but he's stripped of all military rank and sent away to study statecraft and war. So, yeah, not good relations between the two. Next, political marriage is always an important part of any good young noble's life. So Frederick actually suggests a union with Maria Theresa of Austria, who is the same lady that he commented about as we heard earlier. And she would later become his better enemy, by the way. But at this point, he's proposing, why don't we marry her? That would be kind of convenient for Prussia to have this ally with another huge German-speaking state. But instead, William marries Frederick off to Elizabeth, a relative of the Habsburgs in Austria. So just kind of like a little bit further down the line than Maria Theresa herself, not quite as important. Then after that, after Frederick goes through with that marriage and kind of, I guess, follows up on his end of his father's wishes, then he's restored to the military. He studies under Prince Eugene of Savoy. I think that's how you maybe say it, S-A-V-O-Y, during the War of the Polish Succession, in a campaign against the French on the Rhine, which is kind of an interesting little tidbit because that totally exemplifies how these balance of power era wars go. This is the War of the Polish Succession. Okay, Poland. First of all, why is anybody even interested in the Polish Succession? But they are, because it matters to the balance. If, you know, what happens in one state has ripples throughout all of the others. And then furthermore, if it's a war about Poland, why isn't they fighting in Poland? Well, because all of the allies get pulled in and there's fighting everywhere. So this is actually a campaign against France on the Rhine River in Germany. So that's kind of how those wars tended to go. Eventually, the father relents somewhat in his kind of bullying and disapproval of young Frederick, when he gets gout during this War of the Polish Succession, and perhaps he has kind of like a realization of his own mortality, realizes that, hey, you know, Frederick is really my heir, I should probably get him on board with the whole being a king kind of thing. And William kind of comes to terms with him a little bit and grants Frederick a castle named Schloss Rheinsberg, where Frederick surrounds himself with musicians, actors, and artists, and this is actually a time that he remembers as the happiest time in his life. And in 1739, that is when he writes what we're going to read today, a little work called Anti-Machiavel. I'll explain what that's all about in a little bit. But only 1 year later, in 1740, King William dies and Frederick rises to the throne and then suddenly has to stop just being purely an artist and a philosopher and whatnot and has to actually be a king for real and deal with all of the mucky, grimy, unpleasant, in-the-world realpolitik kind of crap that comes along with being a world leader in this era. And eventually, at its height, Frederick will actually take his father's army and double the size of it. Remember how big it was under William? Well, he's going to double it, and it's going to end up consuming 86% of the state budget. So it's going to be huge and hugely expensive. And he's going to take on nearly every major power around him with it and win using brilliant tactics, but also a considerable amount of luck. We'll hear about that later too. And he will be hailed by Napoleon as the greatest tactical genius of all time, even. So, that's the kind of guy that we're looking at today. Okay, so now let's look at some of his writings on war. We're going to read parts of his book Anti-Machiavel, or Refutations of Machiavelli. Yes, that Machiavelli. And this is written, one year before he comes to the throne. So this is before any of his great feats on the battlefield. He doesn't actually have any major military leading experience at this time. He's served and he's studied under Eugene of Savoy, but he hasn't actually fulfilled any of the principles he's going to be talking about yet in this book. So it's pretty likely that he's going to be a little bit idealistic here. And at this point in his life, he's been surrounding himself, remember, with artists and musicians and philosophers. He's been reading utopian idealistic political works, like those by Voltaire and this French guy, Fénelon. And so Frederick is very much a child of the Enlightenment, with all the optimism that comes along with that, believing in the idea of the enlightened absolute monarch, which is essentially what we would call today a benevolent dictator. And he considered that this monarch would be possessed of all the virtues of the ideal ruler. So this Anti-Machiavel is going to be quite an idealistic book. We'll see that. And once we're done looking at that, after that, then we will look at how his actual military career went. We will try to discern, if we can, how this youthful idealism came to be tempered by actual experience in the field, with a corresponding turn toward down-to-earth, practical realism. And we're going to do this in the style of the Public Domain Theater 3000 episodes. And remember that for these, I don't read these works in any depth beforehand, because I want it to be like you, the listener, and I are encountering them for the first time together. So I've browsed this, but I haven't read it in depth. I don't really know what's coming either. So let's see what an idealistic young Frederick the Great, rebellious against Daddy, yet perhaps subconsciously all too eager to please him, has to say about the art of war in the era of the Cabinet Wars and the balance of power. Okay, so I'm first going to go to the part that I know is about the balance of power, a little snippet that led me to this work. Okay, so this is towards the end of the book, actually. And he writes, "The peace of Europe is based mainly on the maintenance of the wise balance of power by which the higher force of a monarchy is counterbalanced by the joined together power of some other sovereigns. If this balance had suddenly tipped, there would be real fear that it heralded a universal revolution and that a new empire will be forged on the remains of the princes whose disunion would make too weak to resist. Okay, so far that seems to fit pretty well with what we've been hearing about the basic idea of the balance of power. He's signing up with this wholeheartedly here. All right, now let's go to the table of contents and let's pick out some chapters that we can kind of pick through a little bit to see what's interesting. Okay, so forward examination of the Prince of Machiavelli. I think we can skip that part. That if you're listening to this, you're interested in history, you know about Machiavelli. Chapter 1, what a strong prince really is and how one can reach that point. That sounds pretty interesting. I think we will start there. And then there's some other chapters later on I see here that look kind of interesting, having to do with whether it's better to be loved and feared, whether you should keep your word. I think we'll check those out after this. Okay, so what a strong prince really is and how one can reach that point. All right, this looks like it's a fairly short chapter. All right, so Frederick writes, "When one wants to reason correctly, it is necessary to start by looking further into the nature of the subject upon which one wishes to speak." Let's see. So he says then he's going to list the differences of the states. Then he says, "Perhaps it would not have been appropriate in a book where the author proposes to codify crime and tyranny as good policy to make mention of what would refute it." Okay, so it seems he's clearly launching into his critique of Machiavelli here. "Machiavelli would have had the bad grace to say that the people found necessary for their own good and preservation to have judges to settle their disputes, guards to protect them and their worldly goods against their enemies, a sovereign power to join together all their varied interests into one common interest. It seems reasonable to assume that they initially chose the ones whom they believed to be the wisest, most equitable, and most disinterested, the most valiant, and the most human to control them." Okay, already I can kind of start to see the idealism of young Frederick here. First of all, he has the balls to take on somebody as respected as Machiavelli on this topic of statecraft, of all things. And then he's kind of leading into this sort of like ideal philosopher king kind of portrait. That's what I'm picking up here. So I think we're getting enough of a drift of what his basic argument to start with is, and now we can move on to more things in detail. And I'm going to skip all the way to the juicier ones that I was mentioning before. Okay, so let's go on. I want to hear about the loved or feared thing. I've always loved this question ever since it came up in the movie Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee. There was an Italian gangster guy who was asked, is it better to be loved or feared? I thought it was an interesting question. Only later did I figure out that it was actually Machiavelli who asked this question. You can guess what Machiavelli's answer was, and I bet we can guess what Frederick the Great's answer is going to be as well. So let's take a look at this. This is chapter 17, Cruelty and Clemency, and If It Is Better to Be Loved Than Feared. This one's a little bit longer, but still short. "The most invaluable deposit, which is entrusted between the hands of the princes, is the life of their subjects. Their load gives them the capacity to condemn the lawbreakers to death or to forgive them. They are the supreme referees of justice. The good princes look at this much sought-after capacity as the heaviest weight of their crown. They know that they are as much men as those who they must judge. They know that wrongs, injustices, and insults can be repaired in this world, but that a death sentence, which is either unjust or simply mistaken, is an irrevocable evil. They only become severe to avoid a more annoying rigor that would see if they act differently. They make these sad resolutions only in some extreme cases, The process is similar to that where a man sees that one of his members is gangrenous. In spite of the tenderness which he has for his own skin, he resolves to cut this part of his body off, to guarantee and to save, at least by this painful operation, the remainder of his body. Okay, so in other words, the only time that a ruler, a good ruler, will want to deal out severe justice, like the death penalty, for an example, will be when doing so saves the rest of the body politic, right? So it's a lesser of two evils kind of an idea. Okay, I get him on that. Machiavelli brings nothing but whimsy to these so grave, therefore serious, therefore significant things. In his lessons, the life of the men is counted for nothing. Interest, this only God whom he adores, is counted for all. He prefers cruelty to leniency, and he advises young men fresh into adulthood to be more callous than all others. The trophy they are told to seek is the reputation of being cruel. So there's Machiavelli's answer. It's better to be feared than to be loved. They are torturers who place the heroes of Machiavelli on the throne and who maintain them there. Cesar Borgia is the hero of this policy when his former servant seeks examples of cruelty. And Machiavelli held up Cesar Borgia as his exemplar of the way a ruler should be. Blah, 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 blah. Skipping down a little bit. I acknowledge that the command of an army cannot be held without severity. How else can the libertines, the cruel, the amoral, the cowards, the overly bold, the coarse, and the mechanical animals be kept at their duty if the fear of punishment does not stop them? Oh, actually, that surprised me. I totally thought he was going to take the other position here. No, Frederick is quite in support of severity. And in fact, later in his career, as I was reading, he does. He makes sure that his soldiers don't desert by having other soldiers behind them ready to shoot them in the back if they so much as look around like they're thinking about deserting. So that's interesting. He kind of, it's not what I would have expected. But again, this is another time. So, interesting. He goes on. All that I request on this subject from Machiavelli is of moderation. It is true that the leniency of an honest man can degrade into overkindness. Wisdom shows that severity cannot be dispensed with altogether, but this severity in its rigor is like that of a skillful sailor. One does not see him cutting the sails, nor the ropes of his vessel, when the hatches need to be battened down, thereby the imminent danger of exposures to the storm or the typhoon. There are occasions when it is necessary to be severe, but never cruel. Okay, here's where he's going with it. Right. Okay, be severe, be an absolute monarch, be that benevolent but severe dictator who does what is necessary for the good of the state, but do not be cruel. All right, that's the line in the sand that he's drawing. I would like better, in battle, to be loved by my soldiers, not feared. Okay, no surprise there. And the next chapter also, I think, is going to be really, really relevant here. Chapter 18, should the princes keep their word? I happen to know that this comes back to bite him in the end once he actually gets to be king. So let's look at this one. The tutor of tyrants, Machiavelli, dares to ensure that the princes can deceive the world by their dissimulation. This where I must start to refute. This is like one of the major things that originally lit the fire under Frederick's ass to write this book. He was incensed that Machiavelli would suggest that leaders should break their word. Remember, the 18th century was still a time when honor was a big deal, and keeping your word was a big deal. But like I said, this is going to get a lot more difficult later once Frederick actually becomes king. But at this time, he has the luxury of being able to give the following opinion. Let's see what it is. It is a fact that the public is curious. They are like an animal which sees all, which hears all, and which reveals all that is saw and what is heard. If the curiosity of this public examines the lives of individuals with no responsibilities over them, it is merely for a diversion and an entertainment. But when it judges character of the princes, it is very much motivated by their own interest. The princes know, far more than other men, the unwritten rules, policies, and judgments of the world, including the ones that are in the near future. They are like the different stars in the sky where the astronomers are inclined to direct their telescopes towards. The courtiers who observe them consider it significant if a mere gesture, a glare, or a glance betrays something that the prince's empty mouth will not reveal, and the people get to know them, quote-unquote, by speculation and guesses. In a word, as the sun cannot cover its spots, no more can the great princes hide their defects at the bottom of their character to the eyes of so many observers. So, in other words, you should be forthright in your character, keep your word, because people are going to know. You're not going to be able to keep it a secret. I don't know about that, but that's what he says. It's also interesting that he mentions sunspots. This is getting to be the time in, you know, the development of astronomy where they have telescopes, and by now I bet they have observed sunspots. That must be it. Okay, so I think we get the drift enough of that. He's very idealistically on the side of be truthful, be forthright, be honest, and poo-poo Machiavelli for ever suggesting otherwise. Very much about honor and being a man of your word. Okay, so I think we're basically getting the drift of this book. But the one thing that I haven't really heard about yet is anything to do with the strategy and tactics of the cabinet wars, the kind of restricted warfare kind of thing. And it may be that it's not really a thing for Frederick yet at this point. But let's see if we can find somewhere that he talks about that. Let's see. Chapter 20. If the fortresses and several other things which the princes often use are beneficial or harmful. Okay, he starts off. Paganism represented Janus with two faces. Okay, another one of these introductions. Here, the first question, should a prince disarm conquered people or not? Okay, so that kind of bears on our topic of restricted warfare. It is always necessary to correct Machiavelli by explaining how much the manner of making war has changed since he wrote The Prince. Now, always disciplined armies, more or less strong, defend the countries. That fits. They're mostly professional armies right now, and drilled to the T, especially in Prussia. Extreme marching and drilling, not because it's supposed to be some kind of fancy parade, but because it was really important for the kind of tactics they wanted to pull off on the battlefield. Especially Frederick the Great had this particular kind of tactic called the oblique move or something like that, where he concentrated most of his force on one side of the line so that he could kind of punch through the enemy on that side and then roll it up from the other side. But it required this move on the battlefield where you had to sort of suddenly march a contingent of troops at the last minute over to that side and catch the enemy by surprise that way, kind of like when a football player kind of runs along the line right before they make the play. And in order to do that without falling out of formation, you have to have really freaking highly disciplined troops. So professional armies, disciplined troops was a big thing at this time. Now, always disciplined armies, more or less strong, defend the countries. One would scorn a troop of armed peasants. Sometimes the citizens take up the weapons, and the professionals do not suffer because of it. To prevent any temptation to revolt, one threatens them with the bombardment and the cannon, the whiff of grapeshot, quote-unquote. It appears prudent to disarm the middle-class men of a conquered city, especially if one has something to fear from them. Da-da-da-da-da. Okay, that doesn't really seem very relevant to what we want to find here. Let's see. Lots of examples. The third question of Machiavelli properly looks at the security of a prince in a hereditary kingdom, if it is better that he maintains union or discord among his subjects. Interesting, but again, not super on topic. We now reach the last question of Machiavelli, if a prince must have fortresses and citadels, or if he must get rid of them. This is very much on the topic, because part of that restricted warfare has to do with obtaining strategic positions, especially strategic fortresses, such that you're basically outmaneuvering the enemy to the point where they know that they're not going to win, and so they just give up without even a shot being fired. Okay, so let's see what he has to say about this. The last wars in Flanders between the emperor and France almost became trench warfare because of the multitude of the fortified towns. That's an interesting kind of reference. Feels anachronistic given that we're looking back from the standpoint of World War I here, but this is, of course, long before that. In open countries, the outcome of two campaigns decides the fortune of the winner and subjects whole kingdoms to him. Alexander, Caesar, Genghis Khan, Charles XII prolonged their glory so long as they found few fortified places in the countries which they conquered. The winner of India made only two sieges in his glorious shifts. The arbiter of Poland never made any more. Eugene, Villars, Marlborough, Luxembourg were great captains, but the fortresses blunted the brilliance of their successes. The French know the utility of the fortresses well, because from the Brabant to the Dauphine, it is like a double chain of fortified towns. The east border of France, on the side of Germany, is like the opened mouth of a lion, which presents two lines of menacing teeth, a mouth that will swallow all invading troops. This should be enough to show the use of fortified towns. Okay. Yeah, so fortified towns, thumbs up. Okay, message received. So that does fit with the strategy of restricted warfare, of taking strategic fortifications in an attempt to sort of checkmate your opponent by the use of them. Well, I can't really find anything else in this work that has to do with restricted warfare kind of tactics and things, which is not surprising me. This is basically political statecraft theory. It's much more overarching and philosophical than tactics per se. And we'll talk a little bit more about restricted warfare a little bit once we finish this in just a moment. But there's one last chapter. The very last chapter is actually really crucial to the whole kind of turn in Frederick the Great's personality as he kind of goes through his career of kingship and warcraft. And that would be chapter 26, entitled Various Kinds of Diplomatic Negotiations and Reasons Which Gives One the Right to Make War. So this kind of bears on the balance of power idea and how you justify getting into a war, especially considering when all these alliances may very well come in against you, and that all the other powers are going to be watching you like a hawk, examining your smallest movement and trying to maintain the balance. And then amidst all this, he's holding up this idea of you're supposed to be the ideal virtuous prince. So what could possibly justify going to war in that whole situation? So let's see what he has to say there. Okay. He says, "We have seen in this work the falseness of the reasoning by which Machiavelli claimed to give us the keys to change by presenting to us degenerates, plain criminals, who know well how to wear the masks of great men. I made my efforts to tear off this veil of virtue which exposes the face of a skull under which Machiavelli has wrapped it, and for defabulating the world of error which so many people inhabit concerning the policy of princes. I add to this two other discussions of principle, a glance at the negotiations of diplomacy and war, specifically what kind one can, to the eyes of God, call justified." And I'm going to skip over the diplomacy part and go straight to the war part. Let's see. So as part of the diplomacy part, that's where he talks about the balance of power, that we quoted at the beginning, which makes sense. Now, here we go. It is now time to discuss war and what makes one just or unjust. Passions and the ambition of the princes often blur the eyesight to the difference and paint in the most advantageous colors actions that are simply violent. War is always a last resort. Thus, one should make use of it only with precaution and with a feeling of despair, and after a thorough examination as to whether one is carried there by an illusion of pride or by a reason that is solid and essential. There are defensive wars, and these are the closest to justice, provided that they are really defensive. There are wars of interest that the kings are obliged to make to uphold rights that are being questioned. They plead their case with weapons in hand, and the engagements tend to decide the validity of their reasons. There are wars of precaution that princes are sometimes wise to undertake. They are offensive with regard to the truth, but they are not the less right. Okay, let's see where he goes with that. When the excessive size of a power seems close to overflowing and threatens to absorb the universe, this sounds like classic balance of power thinking, it is prudence to throw sandbags at it and to stop the stormy course of a torrent while one is still the master. One sees clouds which gather together a storm which is forming, and the flashes which announce it, and the sovereign that this danger threatens, not being able to entreat the storm, will meet, if he is wise, this storm measure for measure. So, in other words, if any one power gets too strong, then it is right and just for the other powers, the other rulers, to make war against them, to take them down a notch. It is prudent to prefer the least evils to the greater, as to choose the trustworthy partner over that which is dubious. It is thus better that if a prince engages in an offensive war, when he is the master, to choose deliberately between the branch of olive and that of the laurel, that he waits until the despairing point, or that a declaration of offensive war is the only thing standing between him and slavery and his ruin. So the olive branch, I believe, represents peace, and the laurel, well, laurels are like victory, right? So that must be war. It is an unquestionable maxim that it is better to prevent than be prevented. The great men are always good at spotting an imminent fight and responding by a surgical use of their forces before their enemies implemented plans that would bind their hands and destroy their capacity to retaliate when war becomes open. Okay, that's a pretty clear argument in favor of preemptive strikes. I mean, that's got like George Bush written all over it. That's they've got weapons of mass destruction. We gotta beat the shit out of them before they use them, and the muddy muck of it. Once you get out of the luxury of idealistic philosophizing he's doing here and get into the real world, is what happens if they end up not having weapons of mass destruction. So he goes on. Many princes engage in wars for their allies by living up to their treaties, in consequence of which they were obliged to provide a number of auxiliary troops. No sovereign can do without alliances, as there are none in Europe which can support themselves by their own forces, because of so many other alliances, no doubt. So they are committed to giving each other mutual help where necessary. This contributes both to their security and to their conservation. The particular event decides which ally draws from the treasury of the alliance. Sometimes an ally gets exactly what they want, other times they have to settle for a consolation disbursement. Honesty and the wisdom of the world requires them also to observe then the faith of the treaties they signed with almost religious devotion. What keeps them inside is the knowledge that they achieve more of their goals through alliances, which make the prince's protection of their people even more effective. Yeah, I don't know how religiously that the powers actually kept their alliances during this period, but all of these wars, the purpose of which will be only to push back usurpers, to maintain legitimate rights, to guarantee the freedom of the world, and to euchre out the oppressions and violences of the ambitious, will be in conformity with justice. The sovereigns who undertake these ones do not have to reproach themselves over the blood that will be shed. The need makes them act, and in similar circumstances, the war is a lesser misfortune than the peace. Okay, so that's a pretty impassioned statement of clear conscience, clear sailing. As long as you're in the right, you'll be fine. Go ahead and go to war, and don't look back. Well, maybe now is a good time to conclude this and see how things actually worked out for good Frederick when he took the throne. So let's put aside now anti-Machiavelli and see what really happened here. So when I look at what actually turned out based on what we just heard compared to what I know of how his career actually played out, it actually reminds me of a time when I was back in like junior high school or maybe early high school and playing Dungeons and Dragons with a friend of mine. And I made this character who thought that we shouldn't just assume that goblins are evil. We shouldn't just attack them outright. We should talk to them first. And my friend totally laughed at me, but let me play this character. And then when we got into it, and the first time that a scary looking goblin came around the corner and I came face to face with one with its, you know, axe drawn, my character was like, ah, kill it immediately. And that's pretty much how Frederick turned out. I mean, he starts out with this very highfalutin, philosophizing, ideal kind of philosopher king idea, but it doesn't really play out so well. In fact, in his very first military conflict, he already finds himself at odds with his ideals. And this first conflict regards a territory adjacent to Prussia, to the southeast, called Silesia, which is part of modern Poland and Czechoslovakia, but was under Austrian control at the time. Okay? And basically, Frederick the Great's family, the Hohenzollerns, had a weak claim to this territory from, you know, ages back, whatever. But the main thing was he was afraid that the ruler of Poland was going to grab Silesia in order to connect his disparate lands and thereby would increase the threateningness of the Polish position against Prussia. So Frederick gets it in his mind to grab it first. Okay, so now I'm going to go to the historian Theodor Scheider, or maybe Scheider, not quite sure how to pronounce it, and he's going to describe the situation here. Soon after his accession, the king, meaning Frederick the Great, through his invasion of Silesia in the closing months of 1740, was embroiled in European politics and found himself in a situation he had only theoretically described in the Anti-Machiavel. Frederick calculated that two things would be in his favor following the death of Charles VI, which was the recently deceased ruler of Austria, the last male Habsburg. Firstly, that the accession to the throne of a female, Maria Theresa, would, despite its legitimacy, meet with resistance and force other states such as Bavaria and Saxony to intervene. And secondly, that the international, or rather global, Anglo-French conflict would draw one of these powers to his side. This assessment proved correct. In June 1741, France concluded an alliance with him. Bavaria made up a third signatory, and Spain subsequently became a fourth. The Silesian conflict grew into a European war fought over Austria's continuing existence. But the expected collapse of the Habsburg monarchy did not come about. Soon the divergence of aims of Prussia on the one hand and France and Bavaria on the other became apparent. So basically, Frederick the Great wanted to use the opportunity of this succession of a woman to the throne to grab Silesia before the ruler of Poland could grab it. And that kind of fits with what he was saying about it's right and just to do a preemptive strike. But here, nobody's striking against Prussia. He's just worried that somebody else is going to get stronger and is already like going back on his ideals, already justifying and rationalizing a war in his mind that, oh, I got to take Silesia before the Polish get it. So in any case, what he ends up doing is like Scheider said, he makes these alliances and he just marches his troops in, taking only 7 weeks, which is apparently really fast for the time, to occupy Silesia. And only afterward does he ask Austria if he can even have it. In other words, he attacks first and negotiates later. And then this conflict becomes a full-on European continental war, dragging in allies as befit the balance of power system. And on his side was France, Spain, Bavaria, Saxony before 1743, Naples, Genoa, and Sweden. And on the Austrian side was Britain, Hanover, the Dutch Republic, Saxony after 1743, so they must have switched sides mid-conflict, Savoie, Sardinia, and Russia. Yeah. So remember the balance of power reasoning that no dumbfuck would be dumbfuck enough to start a war that would drag all of Europe into it? Well, we just found our dumbfuckery of the day. And this war continues for 8 years. And when it finally concludes, Frederick ends up breaking his word. Remember how important it was to him in the Anti-Machiavel that a leader keep his word? Well, already in his first conflict, he breaks his word, because what he does is he concludes a secret armistice with Austria without telling his ally France about it. And this is effectively a betrayal, so he's breaking his word. And then he attempts to justify this by further writings later that say, for example, his hand was forced by others, he had to do it, circumstances made him do it, or by reasoning that reasons of state always take precedence. And then later he even says that only kings are allowed to break their word, though the private individual must never do so. But kings are special, so they can break their word. Already you can see this kind of slippery slope starting, and he's kind of like going whoa, whoa, whoa at the top of the hill right now, and you can just see in a moment he's going to be tumbling down. Eventually he would go so far as to write in a secret testament, which was not to be published until his family, the Hohenzollerns, had ceased to rule, that, quote, the ultimate means by which to conceal one's ambition is to feign peaceful intentions until such a time when it becomes propitious to lay one's cards on the table. All great statesmen have acted this way. So that there, you can see him completely falling down the hill there. In the end, Frederick does get to keep Silesia, but Maria Theresa never forgets it. She just always kind of keeps it in her craw as just a festering wound. And later, after several more kind of conflicts, finally, when the Seven Years' War breaks out, which becomes another huge clusterfuck, multinational huge conflict, and the worst war since the 30 Years' War, Frederick gambles on another relatively swift takedown of Austria, where he'll grab a little bit and then be able to negotiate a peace. But unfortunately, because of that slight that stuck in Maria Theresa's craw, she never forgot about Silesia. She stubbornly refused to concede, being determined to get Silesia back from him at all costs. And the war drags out and drags out, and eventually Frederick's military starts to get worn down and stretch thinner and thinner. Remember how small the Prussian state is. You can't field a huge army when you're that small. What you can do is field really good troops, and if those slowly get killed off, you're kind of screwed. So he gets stretched thinner and thinner until it finally starts to look like his defeat is inevitable. Later, he would estimate that 1 in 9 of all Prussians die in the 7 Years' War. So, and again, given how small Prussia is, that's a pretty devastating chunk of the population. So at that point, he's starting to think about simply trying to preserve what little he can of his territories to hand on to his successor once he dies, which might very well come, like, you know, in the next day or week or battle, whenever the next battle is, and he might just die a soldier's death, so to speak. But he survives the 7 Years' War and actually comes out on top of it, but only through an enormous freaking stroke of luck. Russia switches sides. Russia, formerly his enemy, suffers the death of its Tsar, and the successor, Peter III, just happens to be a huge, like, he idolizes Frederick the Great and the whole Prussian military style. So Peter III, who was a real piece of work, by the way, he literally played with toy soldiers in his room well into his adulthood. There was kind of something going wrong up top. He wasn't quite, I don't know how you would diagnose it these days, but in any case, and also he was so unpopular and such a bad ruler that he may very well have been assassinated by the much more competent ruler, his wife at the time, which we now know as Catherine the Great. But in any case, the accession to the throne of Peter III is Frederick's deliverance. Russia switches from Prussia's enemy to its ally, and Prussia comes out of the Seven Years' War victorious. But Frederick himself was never really the same again after that. And in his final conflict, the War of the Bavarian Succession, he was a much changed leader, in stark contrast to the daring and swift blitzes of his youth when he was blitzing into Silesia and full of spit and vinegar. Now he starts to really fight these wars of position, where you're occupying strategic forts and seeking above all to preserve your troops, because the lesson that he learned in the Seven Years' War is, like, that is your greatest resource if you are a small state, is you have to keep your troops. And so that's above all, you have to use the strategy that keeps your army alive, basically. So now I'm going to go to an author named Palmer that has a few quotes on this. So here you can start to see how he becomes the paragon of that kind of style of restricted warfare, the cabinet warfare kind of idea, where this is now much more about limited actions and, you know, occupying strategic positions, but not out of any kind of noble or like formal kind of rules of warfare. It's because it fits his strategic situation. Okay, so historian R.R. Palmer details kind of the factors why the situation fit. So first of all, in the old regime style of government that you had at the time in Europe, and which would include Prussia, officers pretty much had to come from a hereditary class of aristocrats, which might be a very small amount of the population, rarely exceeding 2%. So if you're all your officers, all your military leaders, those positions are monopolized by a very narrow margin of your population, you're not going to be able to get a whole lot of officers there, and therefore not going to be able to have enough leaders to lead a huge army. You're going to have a smaller army, right? Okay, next, he mentions that for these old regime governments, with their limited resources, the professional armies that they fielded were expensive. So you had to train the soldiers, you had to drill them in these marching techniques in order to be able to pull off the kind of maneuvers that you wanted on the battlefield, like we mentioned earlier. And so that was really expensive. You had a deep investment in your soldiers, so you didn't want to just kill them off. So that's a big factor in why you would want to engage in restricted engagements, because you wanted to only spend them in battle when it really counted. Okay, and furthermore, he says, a large-scale pitched battle between complete armies was therefore a rare occurrence in this period. It was not easy, for one thing, to force a commander to make battle with you, because you had to sort of line up your armies face to face. So if either one of them didn't really want to fight the battle, they could just kind of retreat and you'd be out of luck. It's kind of like a sumo match in that case. I don't know if you've ever watched sumo, one of the rules is if the other guy's not ready, when you start going at him, it doesn't count. So it was kind of like this. And one of the reasons why you might not want to join in battle is because battle was a tremendous risk, and if the advantage was not on your side, then you really didn't want to waste those troops. And so it was actually pretty easy in this sense to preserve your troops and keep the death tolls kind of low. And then R.R. Palmer says, to sum up, many factors combined before the French Revolution to produce a limited warfare fought with limited means for limited objectives. Wars were long, but not intense. Battles were destructive, for the battalion volleys were deadly, but for that reason not eagerly sought. Operations turned by preference against fortresses, magazines, supply lines, and key positions, producing a learned warfare in which ingenuity in maneuver was more prized than impetuosity in combat. War of position prevailed over war of movement, and a strategy of small successive advantages over a strategy of annihilation. So that is what restricted warfare actually was about, at least for the powers in Europe for which it made sense, like Prussia, because it was a small state and had to preserve its army. And that's the situation that Frederick the Great found himself in towards the end of his life and his career as king. And Palmer writes, "The old king, Frederick the Great, in his last years, repeatedly observed that conditions had changed since his youth, that henceforth Prussia could fight only a war of position. He himself, with his great permanent magazines and vulnerable frontiers, set a high value on fixed fortifications. Forts, he observed, were mighty nails which hold a ruler's provinces together. To besiege and overwhelm such fortresses became a main objective of warfare." And later he continues, "In effect, for Frederick, the purpose of battle was to force an enemy to move. Quote, to win a battle means to compel your opponent to yield you his position, unquote. So Frederican war became increasingly a war of position, the war of complex maneuver and subtle accumulation of small gains, leisurely and slow in its main outlines, though never in tactics, and quite different from the short, sharp warfare recommended in 1746. Quote, to gain many small successes, he wrote in 1768, means gradually to heap up a treasure, end quote. And another from Frederick. Quote, all maneuvers in war, he added in 1770, turn upon the positions which a general may occupy with advantage and positions which he may attack with the least loss, end quote. And finally, Palmer gives kind of an epilogue to all this by saying, having made his debut by achieving the most successful revolution in the balance of power effected on the continent of Europe in his lifetime, he became, with the acquisition of Silesia, a man of peace, and ended by believing firmly in the value of the European balance now that Prussia was one of its main components. And he continues, in 1775, he stood for the military status quo. Quote, the ambitious, he wrote, should consider above all that armaments and military discipline being much the same throughout Europe, and alliances as a rule producing an equality of force between belligerent parties, all that princes can expect from the greatest advantages at present is to acquire, by accumulation of successes, either some small city on the frontier or some territory which will not pay interest on the expenses of the war, and whose population does not even approach the number of citizens who perished in the campaigns." End quote. So that is Frederick the Great, as he came to be late in his career, the truest of the true of cabinet warriors, fighting the kind of restricted warfare style. But not because it was some kind of nod to fair play, oh no, because it was the strategic thing to do for his position. That's what restricted warfare was actually about. It had nothing to do with a formalized kind of agreement between the powers that, oh ho ho, we'll all, you know, get our tussle out, and then when the 5 o'clock whistle blows, we'll go home and have a beer together. No, it was not like that. It wasn't an agreed upon sort of formalized game of war. It was a strategy that fit the circumstances of certain powers in Europe at the time. So this was the transformation that we see from the idealistic Frederick the Great when he writes Anti-Machiavel to the late Frederick when he becomes the true cabinet warrior. And Scheider writes, "It must not be forgotten, of course, that these transformations also represented immeasurable losses to Frederick's character. The enthusiasm of his period as crown prince," meaning before he became the king, "which had given rise to the anti-Machiavel, had paled. Although Machiavelli's name was hardly mentioned," meaning after writing Anti-Machiavelli, "the assumption was there that his view of the world, of ingrained and ubiquitous corruption, became more and more an integral part of Frederick's political realism, which came to carry stoic as well as cynical overtones. During the hopelessness engendered by an exhaustive and never-ending war, he produced, in 1761, a letter concerning the wickedness of man, which, although it did not mention Machiavelli's name, was in its analysis of men and their political behavior in almost complete agreement with the Italian. So that's Frederick the Great. And toward the end of his life, he becomes increasingly solitary, closer to his Italian greyhounds than to the remaining friends, the few who had not died in the wars or been killed by this or that. And he writes in his will that he wants to be buried with his dogs. But when he dies, his heir actually buries him with his father instead, which is kind of ironic, given the kind of daddy issues that he had. Although, you could say that probably his whole military career was one big long attempt to sort of please the ghost of his father. And perhaps in that sense, after becoming what history now recognizes as one of the great military minds of history, he gets buried by his father, who perhaps, after all that, would finally be proud of him. All right. Well, that's it for this episode, folks. We will pick up the story again next time with the rise of nationalism, which is going to throw a major monkey wrench into the balance of power system, and which will also set us up to tackle a complicated situation in the Balkans prior to World War I. And if you like what we're doing here, or if you want to ally with either me or Rachel in our struggle for cabinet space in the new house, why not support the show? You can get great perks like your portrait drawn in the time period and culture of your choosing by contributing at www.patreon.com/deadideaspod. All right, I'll see you next time. I'm B.T. Newberg, and this is Dead Ideas.